So 2 Kings chapter 2, Elijah and Elisha go over the Jordan, or where the Jordan once was when they're going over it. And then Elijah is taken to heaven, and Elisha returns. He takes his mantle and he strikes the waters, and they're divided. Verse 15 of chapter 2, when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho opposite him saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. So he is a bona fide, real prophet. They understand that. Inspired by God. In verse 23, when he went up from there to Bethel, he was going up, by the way, young lads came out from the city and mocked him and said to him, go up, you bald head. Go up, you bald head. Now, I don't know what the bald head part is, but obviously it's something that is derogatory. You remember Bethel. What was Bethel or Bethel or however you want to spell it, say it? What was that place?
One of the two places where the golden calves were.
One of the two places where the golden calves were and where the priests of this false religion are. And so what you have here is like father, like son. These are probably, that's a Mecca for false religion here in Bethel. And he's going up there and they say, they start picking on him. They're mocking him. And he looked behind him and saw them and cursed them. In the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out of the woods and tore up 42 lads of their number. And he went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. An attack against God's children, even one of God's children, is an attack on Can you think of another passage that talks about an attack on God's children is an attack on God himself? Wow, you guys are hitting it tonight. Okay, so, right. Remember Matthew 25? Actually, this isn't really an attack on God's children. It's not doing what's right toward somebody, God's child, is not doing what's right toward God himself. This is a very graphic illustration of that. You pick on my man, and Elijah will turn around and curse them, but the fact that it happened means that God authorized that. He says, yes, what he says. And so God said, look, you pick on my man. Don't do it, is the lesson we got out of here. Speaking of vengeance, that's what's happening here. You pick on my man, and I will avenge my man. Romans 12, you know this passage. Romans 12, especially if you're younger and in public school or any kind of school, I hope that none of us who are older deals with this. Verse 14, Romans 12, 14, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Now again, this is not exactly what Elisha did, but God gave him the authority to do that. So this is a general statement to all of us. Look, next time you curse somebody, I don't think God's going to follow through with whatever you said. That's because we have to abide by this general principle. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind. Verse 17, never pay back evil for evil. Respect what is right in the sight of all men, be if possible. So far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved. But leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you'll heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So, not very long ago, I was talking with somebody, and they were justifying having fought. And this is what they said. They were coming at me from, there were multiples of them coming at me from that direction, and multiples coming at me from that direction. What was I supposed to do? Now, what he had done is turned around and punched the guy in the face and sent him to the hospital. He, justifying this, says to me, what was I supposed to do? Now, I want to tell you that I don't ever want to be in that situation. And it's always hard to step back here and say, this is what I'd do in that, or this is what I wouldn't do. But the reality is, when you're not in the situation is when you should be thinking about how you would react when you are in the situation. So, in reality, they're coming at you from all corners. What are you going to do? Suggestions? Punch back? No. We rule the one that's so obvious to everybody, we rule that one out right away. You don't punch him back. What is he saying here? Well, okay, so you don't punch back. What do you do? They're coming at me from everywhere.
Run.
Run.
You defend yourself to a certain degree.
Okay, we'll come back to that in just a second. Right, okay. He said you can defend yourself to a certain degree, so we'll talk about that. But ideally, you know, we're talking about this fight here. If somebody's going to, John says, run. Yeah, oh, but you look like a wimp.
So what?
So, yeah, right. Negotiate. Please, I take back what I said to you. Oh, by the way, this guy had whipped some food at the person who's coming at him. What was I supposed to do? Shouldn't have thrown it to begin with. But now you're in this situation. What are you supposed to do? Run? Negotiate? Whatever you do, God is saying, look, it depends on you. Be at peace with all men. Now, Gary's brought up a valid point. If your life is in danger, that's a different story. We're not talking about the same thing. It might turn into where your life gets to be in danger. That happens all the time now. And that's a different story. In that case, God says, look, you can defend yourself. Here's the funny thing. If the persecution is for your religion, then you can't defend yourself, right? But this is like, you got a whole bunch of bad meanies come at you for no reason other than they're bad meanies. What do you do? Well, you run, you negotiate, and if your life is in danger or somebody else's life, then you can turn. But before that, run. So far as depends on you. Okay. By the way, I'm amazed that in the news how much more and more this is happening in the news. That people are, if you pick up your gun magazine, you know, there's people fighting back all the time. In some cases, they're very justified. In some cases, they're not, right? And we've got to balance the two. Not always easy. Easier said right now than done. Okay, back here in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 3. So this guy, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria. Verse 4. Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder and used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and wool of 100,000 rams. But when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel, and King Jehoram went out of Samaria. And he picks up with him Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat says, where is there a prophet of God? Verse 11, Jehoshaphat said, is there not a prophet of the Lord here? And they say, yes, there's Elisha. Verse 13, Elisha said to the king of Israel, what do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and the prophets of your mother. Those are the false prophets, right? And the king of Israel said to him, no, for the Lord has called me these three kings together to give them into the hand of Moab. And Elisha said, as for the Lord, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look at you nor even see you. And you know the rest of the story. A point from this, it pays to have godly friends, doesn't it? Can you think of any other circumstances where God was planning one thing or would have done one thing but for some godly people? Jonah? Yes, Jonah. Moses? I didn't even think of Moses or Jonah. I mean, I didn't think of many. I'm trying to figure out. Right, so Moses, Jonah. I'm thinking of Sodom and Gomorrah and Abraham. Right. Abraham was praying for them, right? Or petitioning the Lord for them, whatever, however you want to look at it. Judah, the southern kingdom. Why wasn't it already destroyed? How many times do you read over and over because of the promise that he made to David? Now, that's not in the same time, but that's a friend that was 100 years ago. My friend from 100 years ago. Here's the point. I wonder how many times God has bestowed his mercy and grace upon me because of my godly friends and family. Not because of me, but because of my mom or dad or uncle or somebody I don't even know very well is praying and saying, that guy needs help. Right? Maybe right now. I hope that's not the case. By the way, only I know, at least I know what I'm doing. I don't know what other people are praying about. The influence of godly friends only goes so far. Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, you remember them? Oh, Nadab and Abihu, Aaron couldn't do anything for them. Their influence, so don't be riding on somebody else's influence. Okay, that's the point. We've got to get ourselves right away. If you have a comment or question, raise your hand. This dude, verse 4, Mesha, or Mesha, or however you want to pronounce that, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder. Has anybody ever seen this before? In person?
I think we did the Moabite Stone.
Yeah, at the Louvre. Mm-hmm. Did you go?
I did. I don't think. Is it the Louvre? Or?
It's at the Louvre now. I don't know when. It was ancient. They probably just discovered it when you went. So, which is 1868. Okay. So here, this is the Moabite Stone. This dude, this guy, Misha, this is an account of the Moabite Stone, because it's Misha's account of this chapter, and probably more, okay? That's a real picture of it. Here's a depiction of it, the Misha stele, or stele. You can't read. Can you guys read the little writing over here? Oops. No, don't worry about that. I don't know what happened there. Okay, hold on. Let me get this back. All right. Okay, you can't. Neither can I. All right. This engraved stone contains a royal inscription of Misha, king of Moab, during the 9th century. It celebrates Misha's victory over the son of Omri. And that word son can also be interpreted or translated descendant. Here's the descendant of Omri that he had rebelled from. King of Misha was subservient to Ahab, but when Ahab died, he rebelled. And he remains forevermore not subject to Israel. I'm sure you can't read this. He boasts of his victories and he gives glory to Chemosh. And this is the earliest known reference to the name Jehovah outside of the Bible. Is in this when we found it in 1868 from the 9th century. So what's the point, folks? What's the point about, here's that rock that somebody wrote on. What's it got to do with this? The Bible's reliable. Take it to the bank every time. Say, here it is. This is it. You can never shake my faith. The more you read of this, the more I'm convinced it's true. Comments or questions here? Okay. Chapter 4. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves. Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in your house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing except this jar of oil. And he said, go and borrow the vessels. And you know, by the end of it, verse 7, she came and she told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay the debt, and you and your sons can live on the rest of it. So here, when we're introduced to this woman, she's in dire straits. When we leave this woman, after she has an encounter with God and God's man, this woman's fine. Ladies, this chapter is for the ladies. It's also for the men, but when times are tough, any of you ladies ever had times tough times? And if you haven't, might you? What are you going to do? Look at this woman. She's got children. And times are tough. Husband's gone. What are you going to do? What's her answer? What's their answer? Exactly what God's prophets tell you to do. Number one, she went to the man of God. Verse 1. She cried out to Elisha. I don't know if she went to him or he went, but she said, look, here's my problem. You go to God. That's number one. And then you do exactly what God tells you to do. Now, in our day, oh, by the way, in 2 Kings 3, it's direct. This is what you do, God says to her. Wouldn't that be nice? What are you going to do? Nowadays, it's not direct and specific. It's general, right? What are some general things that anybody who's in dire straits, what do? Pray. That's good. I'll go home and just pray my way into some cash. We have to pray.
And go to God's people.
Go to God's people.
That's what you did.
Before we go to God's people, what do we have to try to do? Before we go to God's people. Yeah, take care of ourselves, and how would we do that? We'd go out and we'd try to get a job, right? He who does not work, neither let him eat. Well, I'm trying to work. Okay, and then we go to God's people, Christians, and then the church, maybe family also, maybe even the government. But through it all, remember Matthew 6, 33 and 34, what does it say?
Seek first God's kingdom. All these things will be added to you. Don't worry about it.
Tough. Easy to say now, right? Because everything's fine right now. But that's the general principle. When you get into the situation, what are you going to do? Especially the women. Look at this. This is a tough situation. It could be you. Remember Hagar and Ishmael? What didn't they have? Water. Anything. Right. What was provided for them? What they needed? Water, right? God can do it. Naomi and Ruth, tough times. And they come back to the land, and what do they get? Everything and more. So God can do it. Just remember that in the tough times. In the meantime, you might go without food and warmth. It might happen. But in the end, even if that end is death, remember, this is about perspective. Even if the end is death, it will have been worth it to trust God. Okay. Verse 8, there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, and there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was. As often as he passed by, he turned in to eat food. She said to her husband, "Behold, now I perceive that this holy man of God passing by us, this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please let us make a walled upper chamber, and let us set a bed for him there, and the table, and the chair, and a lampstand, and there it shall be that when he comes to us, that he can turn in there." And so they go ahead and do it. You read the story. Single ladies, what can you do? Really, you're only, number one, you're women. Number two, you're single. What can you do in God's kingdom? Here's your answer. Now, I know that this person is married. We'll get there in just a second. But what did she do? She sees a man of God, and she says, "I know what I can do. This guy needs some kind of help." In this case, it manifested itself as food. The way to a man's... No. Although that might be true and applicable. But it's food. And so she says, "Here, this is what I can do. I can give him food." Here's your answer. Maybe pay for a hotel. That might be prudent. Instead of, I think I'll build him a room in my house. Okay, maybe pay for a hotel, whatever. And by the way, maybe pay for a hotel. Preacher's coming to town. Mr. Sewell's coming to town. Single ladies, if there are any. Got money? Maybe this is a way you can help. Not totally unreasonable. This stuff is important. Remember, think about to the future. Actually, this is the requirement of anybody, really, but we're talking about widows. 1 Timothy 5:9, a widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she's washed the saints' feet and has assisted those in distress, and she's devoted herself to every good. This is what we're talking about. This is what this woman back here in Shunem is doing. Oh, by married ladies, it looks like the woman was more spiritually minded than the man was. Did you get that out of this? When Elisha goes by, she persuades him to give him something to eat. And then she says to her husband, "Please, let's make this little walled room." And then Elisha calls his servant and says, "Call the Shunammite woman, not the man." And then later on, when the son is dead, she went and got the man. It seems like the guy is just somewhat there, and she's the one that's spiritually minded. Husbands, nervous? Who's supposed to be the spiritual leader of the house? Thought we're going to have to go back to put this aside and go on. Okay, right. Yeah, rhetorical. Right. So the man is. Now, by the way, more spiritually minded is different from spiritually mature. Okay, maturity comes with time and teaching. But spiritually minded, who's that up to? Me. When? Right now. I can fix that. I might not be mature for a long time, but I can be spiritually minded right now. That's up to me. Anyways, women, it seems like the man was not quite up to par. Here's the woman, here's the man down here. What do you do? Here's your answer. Look at what she did. She did what she could. She made the most of the opportunity. She even involved the husband. Husband, you know, hey, here's something that we can do, right? She gave it a shot. Husband, can we? What else is she? She can't say, husband, we're going to do this. She can't. So she says, hey, I've got an idea. Let's try this. And notice that she said, please, please let us make. Well, that's because she's in the subservient role, right? And she can't say, we're going to make this now. So she's got to come to him and say, please, can I? And this is exactly the way it ought to be approached. Comments or questions here? I'm sorry, what? It says something like I just said. Okay, so chapter 4, we'll go on. The kid, the child was grown, verse 18. The day came when he went out to his father and the reapers. He said to his father, my head, my head. And he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. And she had taken him and brought him to his mother. He sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. Then he died. Moms and dads, catastrophically sick child, what do you do? Here's your answer. Now, this child has already died. And if you're reading the text straight, you'd say you sit there and hold him until he dies. But what does she go on to do? When he dies, what does she do? She goes to the man of God, right? Here's your answer. Go to God. And for us, it'll be in prayer. Example like David did. Remember when his little baby was dying? 2 Samuel 12, I think. It's either 11 or 12. I think it's 12. Yeah, he says, look, I'm praying. I'm praying. As long as this child's alive and sick, I'm praying to God. That's what we do. Child dies. What do you do? Again, here's your answer. No, you're not the only one, by the way. This woman had a child who died. And I'm not trying to minimize the pain and sorrow and suffering that would be involved in this. I'm not trying to at all. But you're not the only one. Remember, it's easier to think of these things and prepare ourselves now than when we're going through it. You're not the only one. Don't get angry at God. Don't do it. Don't get angry at God. Instead, appreciate that. Remember Job? I've had good things, and God gave them to me, and they're all gone now, including all of his children. And he said, God gave, and God takes away. Blessed be the name of God. I was talking to somebody at the fair. Ethan works with this person. This person says, I said, do you believe in God? And she says, yeah, I do, but right now I'm a little either confused or angry or both. I forget which it was.
Not good on the bad thing. That's kind of how
she did it, yeah. Oh, why? A little two-year-old in Theresa drowned. That was her best friend's kid. And how did this girl react? I'm not trying to be harsh. People die. That is life. People die all the time. You will die. Your parents will die. All of your loved ones will die. Your children will die. Maybe your child will die before you do. Maybe mine will before. Maybe I'm pointing right back at myself. Lee, when this happens, don't get angry at God. Anybody ever hear the problem of pain? That's what this is right here. Everybody says, God let it happen, so I'm angry at God. We can't do that. Do your part and look forward to being with that child in heaven. That's what David did, right? Now, actually here, the lad is grown. When the child was grown. So you don't know if that child's going to be in heaven. We just don't know. But for the young child, what do? We do our part to make sure, hey, my little baby's there. There. I'm going to go too. Comments or questions here? Okay. So. He sends Gehazi. Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand. Go your way. This is verse 29. Gird up your loins. What does that mean?
Prepare.
Has anybody done that? Prepare.
Yeah.
Yes.
Make haste, get moving.
Get moving. Right. It's we would hike up our pants is what we'd do. Hike them up because we're about to run. Cinch up your belt, whatever you got to do.
My version says tie up your garment.
Yeah, that's right. That's literally what it is. Gird up your loins. And, well, actually it's your loins, but tie up your loins. And take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. If anyone salutes you, do not answer him. Well, that's rude. What is the point?
Focus,
the utmost priority. I can only think of one other place in the entire scripture that it uses this. Maybe you can think of another. Can anybody guess where I'm thinking of?
Is that when Jesus said his mind to go to Jerusalem? Is that what you're thinking of?
No. Maybe it's there.
I'm not sure.
Okay. In Luke 10, when he sends out the evangelists, maybe that's speaking of something. In Luke 10, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of harvest. Verse 3, go, behold, I send you out as lambs in the midst of the wolves. Carry no money belt, which means trust God. No bag, no shoes, and greet no one on the way. Really? That's funny that their job is to greet people and talk about God. His point is, you need to go there and teach these people. Spread the gospel. Don't dilly-dally. Be focused, have a priority, is what he's saying right here. As far as I know, this is the only other place in Scripture where this is used. Maybe it is. But, so what we understand from this is evangelism, for the evangelist especially, there is no more important job than evangelism in this entire world. Having said that, that is not to say that there's not another job as equal to it. Okay? In 1 Corinthians 5, a man has his father's wife. And what does Paul say? By the way, what is that? It is destroying the local congregation. That's what's happening. The local congregation is being destroyed. And what does Paul say? Remove him when?
You should have done it already, as I
have. Right, exactly. The next time, when you are assembled. It's the same idea. Don't dilly-dally about this. So we have this evangelism, teaching the gospel to the lost, is extremely, don't dilly-dally. And another thing, something's going on with the church, those who are already saved. Don't dilly-dally, don't lose your focus. We got to hold each other together. Now, I'm not saying that being an engineer is not as important as these things. I'm not saying that being a mommy isn't as important as these things. I'm just talking about these two things. We have this expression here. One of them is, when you're evangelizing, don't greet people on the way. And when there's a problem in the church, you take care of it. Two very important things in life. Okay. Before we go on, I want to go backwards just for a minute. Did you find another one? Okay. In 2 Kings, verse 8, chapter 2, verse 8, Elijah took his mantle and folded it together and struck the waters. And they were divided there. On the way back, verse 13, Elisha takes the mantle, strikes the waters, and they're separated there. And then there are some people who have some bad water, spring water, and he says in verse 20, bring me some salt, and I'll throw it into it. Chapter 3, when Elisha says to Jehoram, I have nothing to do with you but for Jehoshaphat, he goes on, verse 15, bring me a minstrel, and he starts prophesying to him. In chapter 4, we have the oil, and then we have the staff. Take your staff and lay it on the lad's face, in verse 29. And then in verse 34, to actually resurrect the child, he lays his own body on the boy. And then there's some poisonous stew, in verse 41, and he says, bring me some meal, and he throws it in the pot, and he fixes everything. And then in chapter 6, I know I'm jumping ahead, you read about this, when the axe head falls, he says, here, go get a stick, and he throws it in the water. Now, I want to bring up something else, too, at the same time, because all of these remind me of Numbers 21. Numbers 21. There is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people. So many of the people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken out against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord, Numbers 21, that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he will live. And Moses made the serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked on the serpent, he lived. We could keep on going. But what do we have here? Mantle. Mantle. Minstrel. Salt. Meal. Axe head. Here's something that I'm understanding. I guess God can use whatever symbolic means he wants to. He did it with the mantle. Forgive me for being repetitious for a minute. He does it with the salt. He does it with the minstrel. He does it with the staff. He does it with the body. He does it with the meal. He does it with a stick. He does it here with a snake. I guess God can use whatever symbolic means he wants to. If you remember this slide from last week, although the words have changed, we need to get into our heads that God can use whatever symbolic means he wants to. I'm sorry. Do you not like repetition? Remember Peter? All right, let's ask ourselves a question from here. I was hoping Ian would be here. Would it have worked for Israel if they had not included the symbolic means of looking at the snake? No, God, we're just going to forget about the snake tonight. I know you said the snake, but we're just not going to use it. Would it have worked? No. Would it have worked if Elisha had not used the symbolic means of the stick? Now, you could argue that it would have, but you can argue the same thing with Nehushtan, which is that snake, right? And by the way, who wants to try it? Who wants to try it without the symbolic means? Any takers in here? No, right? Okay. So we can go up all the way up there and say, look. It applies to all of these. Now what's the application? 2 Kings 2. Or that is 2 Kings 5. Naaman, he's got leprosy. The little girl, oh, by the way, little girls, what can you do? What can you do, little girls? Little or not. You can say, hey, I know somebody who knows about God. Because that's what this little girl is. Okay. So, verse 8, when it happened, Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes. He sent word to the king, saying, why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, that he shall know there is a prophet in Israel. Okay, that's the major theme of this section. We could have moved on from there last week or the week before, but we're camping out and get some lessons. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood in the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent the messenger to him, saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times. And your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean. But Naaman was furious and went away and said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpah, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the rivers of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and he went away in a rage. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Did God need the water? Did he need to do it 7 times in the water? But yet, if Naaman hadn't have done it 7 times in the water, what wouldn't have happened? And that's the point. Was the water the basis for his cleansing? Was the act of being baptized the basis for his cleansing? No. But was it a condition for his cleansing? Right. And imagine Naaman almost tried it for a minute there. No, I'm not gonna do it. And it didn't go over too well for him. John, you want to make a point?
Well, I think Naaman needed it. He needed to do it 7 times.
Yes.
There was something that was a block for him, and that gave him some sort of an obstacle. And
right.
He had to decide, am I going to do this or not? He made the wrong decision initially.
Right, initially.
But can you imagine what was going through his mind when he came out of the water the 7th time?
Yeah. Right.
Because that, I mean, flesh like a baby. This guy's a general.
Right.
He runs the army. And guess what?
He looks like a baby. No, your point, right. Yeah, he just went, his whole new life started right there. And he said, I know what he was thinking. Some of it. Gary, you want to make a point?
Well, this is where we have to be careful. God says, but I think. God says, be baptized. I think. The way he wrote it is.
Right.
God says, men are temptation
of all. Right.
But I think women could teach and preach and whatever it is.
Yeah.
Be careful what I think.
Yeah.
God says, but. Oh.
Yeah, you stop right there.
Right. Yeah, what, you're saying this. What was Naaman's problem? What was his initial problem?
He thought.
Behold, I thought.
Yeah.
And we learn from there that we don't get paid to think. We get paid to listen. Once we've discovered what it is we're told to do, then we just go ahead and do it. Compare Acts, right? And a whole slew of other passages in the New Testament that say that if you want to be cleansed, what do? Ever since Christ has died, ever since Acts 2, if you want to be cleansed, what do? You jump in the water.
Why are you waiting?
Right. Now, again, is it the basis? No. Is it the condition? Yes. We understand. No, God is the one doing the cleansing. My dipping in this Jordan 7 times had nothing to do directly, inherently, with coming out with baby like skin like a new baby. Or a little child, whatever.
I was going to make kind of the same point. It's like us when we're being saved. Is baptism the basis? No, but just like him, if we don't do it, if we turn around and say, I don't want to do it, it doesn't make sense. Why would we need to do it? He's still not going to reap the benefits.
We done thought again. don't do the thinking. Naaman's problem was his preconceived expectation. And by the way, he had flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. Now, do you remember what John 3:3 and 5 say? Nicodemus comes up to him.
Bless a man be born again.
Right. Born again. I'm telling you, if you were born again, you would have flesh like a little child. Now, obviously, it's a picture. It's not literal. In fact, being born again in the passage is talking about baptism, right? So, John 3:3 and 5 say, unless you're born again. Titus 2:5 says that we are saved not on the basis of our works which we have done in righteousness, but by, I forget exactly what it says, but includes the washing of regeneration. Sounds like somebody was generated again, right? And then Romans 6:3-4 says, look, you're baptized into his death to walk a new life. This is the picture is, I mean, how can you miss it? Once it's there, once you see it, once it's shown, that is. Comment or question on this? All right, now for the fun part. When he returned, verse 15. Yeah, when he returned to the man of God with all his company and came and stood before him, he said, behold now, I know that there is no God in all of earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now. But he said to him, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And he urged him to take it, and he refused. And Naaman said, if not, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth. For his servant will no longer offer burnt offerings, nor will he sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. We have three things that we see in here. Number one, Naaman made the right deduction. When he walked out of that pool, what did he know? There is one God. Remember, that's the whole theme. The whole theme of this entire Bible, especially this section, is everybody around here will know that there's one God, Jehovah. He knows it. Number two, he makes the right dedication. He says, here's a gift for you. Now, do you remember what 1 Corinthians 9:11 talks about? I just referred to it the other day.
Paying preachers.
Right? Because if we sowed spiritual things with you, don't we have a right to reap material things? That's what's going on here. Essentially, he says, hey, look, somebody just saved my life. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to give him what I have. And then he made the right determination, didn't he? He said, look, give me some earth, because I will no longer offer burnt offering nor sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord himself. It's as simple as that. It's so simple. Here comes God. He does something for you. What do? You say, look, he's the only God, and I'm going to worship him. Easy as that. Verse 18. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. Okay, so he just said, I'm going to worship God alone, Jehovah alone. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, And he leans on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. And he said to him, go in peace. So he departed from him some distance. Okay. What's happened here? The issue? Forced aiding of another in false worship. That's what he's... Look, my boss tells me, you're going to go in here. And you're going to help me. And I'm going to lean on you. And when I bow, you're going to bow. So the issue is, it's forced. Okay. The exception. He says, look, when I go in there, please pardon. Now, what does he understand about this act that he's doing? It's wrong. He knows it's wrong. By the way, that comes naturally. It's natural. Hey, when there's a real God, then some things are naturally, automatically wrong from that. He didn't even need to read Genesis 1 through anything to get there. Okay. So Elisha says to him, go in peace. Elisha says to him, go in peace. What's going on here?
It's kind of parallel to eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols.
Okay.
Sense, I think.
A little different. To split hairs. We'll get there. Let's back up for a second. What I'm getting at here is, what does Elisha see? Elisha understands this guy's heart is in the right place. Okay? Anybody disagree with that? I don't think so. Okay. So what we have here, all right. Now, is false religion and everything involved with it wrong? Yes. Does God hate it? Yes. Okay, what do we have here? An illustration of God's patience. And mercy and grace. Here, this guy's doing something, and in fact, he knows he shouldn't be doing it. But God says through Elisha, okay, here's an exception, right? Okay, does anybody in this class, here tonight, not think there's a pattern in the New Testament? I think there is a pattern. Everybody else? Have we talked about it ever? Once or twice? I am firmly convinced there's a pattern and we need to stick to it. Everybody else in here on the same page? Okay, having said that, we have to make room for what John was hinting at a little bit earlier. And this is God's grace. We're going to talk about God's grace for a minute, okay? Here is a modern parallel application. An unbelieving father demands a 14-year-old Christian daughter to accompany him to fall. He's a Baptist, she's a Christian. The father says, daughter, you're going with me. Number one, you have to understand, the father has no authority from God to say that. Okay? Remember, this is Acts 5. We must obey God. And if the daughter is thinking perfectly correctly, at least as I understand, she's going to be thinking, God, father, you don't have any authority. But I'm going to guess she's going to be, what has she got a balance between?
There's also the pay honor to whom honor is due.
Right. And so how does this all work together? Okay, so the daughter's trying to figure things out. Please God while obey the father. The daughter attends with the father and participates, quote unquote, without the heart involved, because that's Naaman. Naaman's like, I'm going to be there. It's going to look like I'm going through the motions, but my heart is not there. It's back here with my two bags of dirt until she can, quote unquote, escape, right? Okay. Should she be there in the first place? No. Because Ephesians 5 says, don't participate in the deeds of evil, but expose them. 2 Corinthians 6 says, what fellowship does light have with darkness? Acts 5:29 says, look, we have to obey God rather than men. Should she be there in the first place? But no, and this is really getting to what John was talking about. She's a little confused, maybe. She's wrestling with this. And I'm not saying I know the answer while I was right there. I think I do, but I'm not going to put myself in that situation. And just like immodest dress, is immodest dress wrong? I mean, there's some that's obviously everybody, they used to know it's wrong. And then there's immodest dress that not everybody really gets. That immodest dress that not everybody really gets. Okay. On the end that you're like, okay, this is going to take a little time. This is going to take a little time for them. Is God condemning them? Because God understands that we are all fallible. Every single person in here, as far as I know, does not have 100%, not necessarily have 100% knowledge of what this Bible says at any given time. And so we could be wrong. And so that necessarily implies God's grace, because we, at least in the past, might have been doing something that was wrong, especially when we're a new Christian. I mean, there's a lot out there that, especially when the world says, oh, just go ahead and do all this stuff, we come out of that. There are some things, you got the plan of salvation down, great. And now there's the rest of it. Here comes this. But this all implies God's grace. Ethan.
In Philippians, it says we're to work out our own salvation. Mm-hmm. Basically, we're figuring that out. None of us have it all figured out.
Right. And as we learn, we do. As we learn, we do, or as we learn, we don't do, whichever the case might be. All right. So here's another parallel situation. Unbelieving husband demands wife to accompany him for false witness. It's the same exact situation. Husband has no authority from God to require this. Wife is trying to figure things out. Wife attends with husband but participates without the heart involved until she had escaped. Should she? No, because of all these same reasons. But she's confused, and just like with women, should you have long hair? What's the Bible say about women and hair? Long. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, right? Long hair. Okay? So you become a Christian, and wham, it's all off already. Is God... I haven't known one short-haired woman to go to hell immediately and be struck dead because of having short hair. Right? But the Bible says to have long hair. Well, what's... And maybe it takes her 2 years to come around to, you know what? That really does mean what it says. What's God doing in the meantime? You're breaking the law. God's being gracious to you, right? Here's a modern, not really parallel. And then one that's not parallel at all. A new Christian assembles and partakes of the Lord's Supper with cake and soda. Okay, there's a difference between this scenario and the ones we've been talking about. This one is purely ignorance, and the others were mostly, primarily, forced. You have to go here and do this. I'm the husband. I'm the father. You must go here and do this. This is not talking about that. This is talking about a whole bunch of new... This is talking about just plain old ignorance. Okay? So, here's my point. If you were to compare 2 Kings 5 and say, look, oh yeah, God does all right with that because 2 Kings 5, well then you've just made a class category mistake, because 2 Kings 5 isn't talking about ignorance. 2 Kings 5 is talking about you must do this. Somebody's saying to you that, okay? Informed Christians partake of the Lord's Supper with cake and soda, and they have instrumental music, and they have this and that and everything else. Informed Christians. Oh, 2 Kings 5 says God made an exception back there, so informed Christians can do all this. Again, we've made a class mistake here. God's talking about one class over here, and he says, well, there's an exception over there, and then suddenly just to make that apply to everything, that doesn't fly.
There's a difference between the two. One is ignorance, one is rebellion.
Exactly. In the two right here, you mean.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. That's why I say not really parallel. Okay, so the ignorance, you can. John was hinting that direction. You know, what are you doing? What are you doing? Well, in one situation, you don't. And the other one is just pure old presumption. I know what the Bible says about the Lord's Supper and this and that, but I'm going to do this anyway, and that is totally, totally different. Oh, but God made an exception back there. Boom. You need to read the rest of the Old Testament, right? Okay. Class mistake, forced versus presumption. A conscientious mind recognizes the problem, doesn't it? Naaman illustrates that a conscientious mind recognizes, hey, this isn't right. This isn't right. And a conscientious mind seeks an explicit exception, if they can find one. Naaman found one. But we need to go find one. Okay, so partaking of the Lord's Supper is, I say Lord's Supper. Why do I have that in quotes, by the way? It's not the Lord's Supper. Because what is the Lord's Supper?
Unleavened
bread and fruit of the vine. And so if you take something else and put it in there, it's not the Lord's Supper, right? Anybody else? Now, you might agree with some of the semantics that I've thrown out here, or disagree, or maybe I hope you agree. But are we relatively on the same page here? Anybody disagree? Think I've got it wrong? That's okay. if I am wrong. Okay, here's another scenario that just to run, this would be the last one. Okay, you've got Christians, and unleavened bread and fruit of the vine is unavailable. And by the way, this happens all the time in other countries, and it might happen with us if things keep going the way some of us think they're going. So, partake of the Lord's Supper with leavened bread and orange juice. Or just leavened bread because you don't have any juice at all. Or maybe just orange juice because you don't have any bread at all. Or maybe just fruit of the vine because you don't have any bread at all. Have I confused everybody? This is unavailable. At least one or both is unavailable. Unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. One or both of those is unavailable. What do you do?
What do I do, or what's the right thing to do?
Yeah, right. I'll run through this with what I would do. Now, I'll tell you that some people who are very close to this congregation differ with me. Okay? So I'm going to tell you what I'd do. Here's my opinion. We just talked about the last one. If it's not this, then it's not that. And so you don't do it. Here's either way you have an exception, actually. Either way you have an exception. Okay? Now, whether or not it's a good exception or not, I'm saying either way you have something that's not being done. On Sundays, we should partake of the Lord's Supper. Okay? I can't partake of the Lord's Supper because it's unavailable. Well, then you have a Sunday where you didn't do something you should have done. Or, the other scenario is, the elements are unavailable, so I'll just substitute one, in which case you have again done something you shouldn't have done. So either way. But one is presumptuous. I'll just throw in this substitution here, the peanut butter and jelly.
One's an omission only, one's an omission and a commission.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But right, a one-two combination. All right. So, by the way, they made exceptions. They made exceptions. For example, 2 Kings 5. No, 2 Kings 5 is talking about something forced, okay? This is not talking about force. This is talking about unavailability. Two different things. All right. There are exceptions in the Old Testament. For example, 2 Chronicles 30, Nehemiah prays and says, look, it's the second month. They're supposed to take the Passover in the first month. He says it's the second month and they're all unclean. And so he says, God, we pray that we can partake of it anyway, even though we're unclean. And they did, and God said he heard their prayer. Okay? So you can turn there and say, look, God made exceptions. True, God did make exceptions. But in 2 Chronicles 30, either this passage teaches that all we have to do is pray. Every time we break a rule, just pray about it. Or it emphasizes this one time, this would be the exception proves the rule. This is an illustration of that. This one time I'm allowing it. No other time. This one exception proves that the rules in case every other time except for this one time. Anyways, you're making assertions from the life before the New Testament about life under the New Testament. Right? And we live under the New Testament. If we're going to find an exception, where had we better find it? In the New Testament, right? Okay, 2 Corinthians 8:12, and this is where people differ with me, I differ with other people. It says, you got to read the context for later. It's about taking up a collection. Paul says, look, you guys better do it. Remember the folks up there in Macedonia? They're doing it with all their hearts. Verse 11, I told you a year ago, start doing this. Verse 11, now finish doing this also. So that just as there was the readiness and desire, so there also be the completion of it, of your ability. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. It is according to what a person has. If the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. Now, this is how this verse is applied. Oh, we don't have fruit of the vine? Let's just partake of the bread. I say no, like some people in here are voicing, because it's not the Lord's Supper. However, I'll tell you that there are some smart people, kind and compassionate and loving and smart, smarter than I am, people very close to us who disagree with that. And they say, look, that's what it says. I would say, It's talking about the ability of an individual. That's what it's talking about. The person has, not the act of the local congregation, not to give. To not give much is explicitly authorized. You know where? Right here. You don't have to give much. In fact, you don't even have to give any at all. It's up to your ability. It's explicitly authorized. Where? Right here. As opposed to alter the Lord's Supper or mechanical or whatever else, we don't have any other explicit authorization to alter these things. Is it necessarily implied here? I come up with no, it's not, and maybe I'm missing it somewhere. Willingness is not all that matters. Remember that if the readiness is present, was Uzzah ready? Yes. He wanted, out of respect, he wanted to guard that ark. And God said, your heart is not all that matters right now. What also matters is you keep my law. And my law says, don't touch that ark. We could, anybody who's read the Old Testament understands that the heart isn't the only thing that... Yes, we have to have the heart in the right place, but it's not the only thing that matters when it comes to keeping God's commandments. Any thoughts? Other people had thoughts, I know. Mindy?
So if you're just to not maintain a local congregation...
You mean a lot of people come and join?
Yeah.
Okay. I think the Lord, if they are sinning, are they missing the mark? I think that the commandment is more along the lines of, it's going to sound like I'm about to contradict what I just said, but you are, according to your ability, okay? This, you know, there's no bread. Well, God assumes, the commandment assumes that there's fruit of the vine and unleavened bread available. And a building and a place to meet and other Christians. What if they all died? Same thing. What if all the other Christians died except one? Are they sinning? Or I'll say two, because two could assemble. Are they sinning and not coming together? No. You know, this assumes that life is normal, I'll say. That's really poor wording.
God's not going to require something beyond your
ability.
Right.
Yeah, the difference is people are applying it, this passage, if the readiness is there, what does it say? If the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what he has. People are applying this to a ceremony that God has said, this is the ceremony, A and B. And if you don't have A and B, then you don't have a ceremony. And people are saying, I don't have B, so I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, in which case they're not doing the ceremony. Or they're going to say, I'm going to do C, A and C, in which case they're not doing the ceremony. Okay? Which is a false application of this passage, if I understand the Bible correctly. However, if there's no fruit of the vine available anywhere, then you go and you assemble, assuming that you can, and you miss the Lord's Supper that week. By the way, you can still think about it.
And that's the willingness is there.
Right.
The willingness is there. The ability is not.
Right.
Do you think that fruit of the vine is limited to grape juice?
I don't.
You don't. So there are other possible substitutes.
Let me back up. I thought you meant wine. A grape product. I believe it's limited to a grape product. Well, like, what other... There are other vines. I forget which they are. But. Yeah, right, I don't. That's my understanding. It's grapes. Now, I'm not exactly prepared to show that right now, why I think that. Wasn't expecting that one. That's a good one. I've heard it before, though. I mean, I just am unprepared. You had something.
So, this part of 2 Corinthians is talking about contributing. And when it gets to the issue of according to what they have, not what they don't have, I think he's kind of reemphasizing the point Jesus made with the widow and the two mites. And so there's no parallel to be made because it's emphasis on the amount in contrast to the willingness, not the thing itself. You know, you don't have money, so give bubble wrap. But that doesn't, you can't even make a parallel logically. You know, oh, I'm going to do a completely different thing. No, he's talking about a contribution. You have this much, because you're willing. You have a lot less, give that much, because you're willing. You know, it's what you have. It's what you have. And it's the same substance. It's not switching it out for something entirely different.
That's what I think. Anybody else? Okay.